Have a good evening. Okay. Technology. So one of the topics that I'm currently working on for my thesis, and basically what I'll be talking about today, is identity in virtual worlds. Pretty obvious. But I'm especially going to talk about the context of online persistent worlds, talking about Second Life, the video game, which you can see up there. That's my character looking out. Although persistent worlds, open-ended worlds that are in use 24/7, have existed since 1978 when Richard Bartle created the text-based MUD, or multi-user dungeon, it is only in the past few years that the technology has progressed far enough to create a truly immersive world. And that's the first multi-user dungeon that existed, MUD 1, where basically you just type in northeast, northwest to walk that way. You type in your chat that you want to chat with people, you know, pick up your sword, fairly simplistic stuff. In 1986, the first multiplayer graphical role-playing game, Lucasfilm's Habitat, was released on Quantum Link, which is now AOL. You can see that it's obviously gotten a little bit better graphically, but in the end, it's still basically just a glorified chat room. Although Habitat can be considered a breakthrough in online world development, it wasn't until 1997's Ultima Online by Origin Systems that the term massively multiplayer online game could be used. Within the first year, 100,000 people signed up to play what many at the time considered a glorified chat room. But at least in Ultima Online, you were able to do a lot more than you could in the previous ones, where you can go fishing or you can go build, you know, or go bacon, all that. So there's a world that you can do more than just walk around and chat. Today, Worlds of Warcraft is considered the largest online world with up to 3.5 million subscribers worldwide. Altogether, it is estimated that over 10 million unique people subscribe to various online persistent worlds throughout the world. And again, it's obviously gotten much better graphically, and you can still do a lot more in the game. I'll get into that later. From the simplest games like Worlds of Warcraft, where the basic goal is to be the best and most cunning warrior, to alternate reality games that mix reality with fiction by having the player's real life be a part of the game, our concepts between online, offline, and real virtual have slowly become blurred. A class called Poker, for example, seems like a simple poker website with a non fascination with death until you start receiving phone calls, faxes, and emails from other players at the tables, including ones that you thought had been killed recently. Not only does the game involve your real life in this way, the game's creators, 42, have created real-life poker tournaments, which are similar to murder mystery dinners, where you go and meet these players that you thought might have been fake, but end up being real players. There are two very tragic examples of reality mixing with virtual worlds. Recently, a man murdered his best friend after the friend sold his virtual sword for $900 on eBay. Also earlier this year, a 28-year-old died after playing 50 straight hours at an online internet cafe, taking only short breaks. And he was specifically playing StarCraft, which is up there on the top left. It is no surprise that then, it is no surprise then that through what John Searle calls collective intentionality, these worlds actually allow people to begin living secondary lives online. Jean-François Lyotard, in The Postmodern Condition, a report on knowledge, was prescient when praising decentralized computer networks as a medium for social change, and foretelling the use of anonymous pseudonyms on these networks. Today, online pseudonymous games such as StarCraft have become what's considered a national sport, spawning 3 television channels and engrossing 5 million game players in South Korea alone. And these on the top right and bottom left, you can see the family watching their son playing StarCraft in an online tournament. Supposedly around 3 million people were watching that tournament, the tournament itself, and then one-on-one at the end of the tournament. Fortune magazine calculates that with 4 million players of the game Madden 2004 and an average playtime of 100 hours in a year, the game will have 400 million viewing hours, while cable television's then most popular show, The Sopranos, with its 11 million viewers and 13 one-hour episodes in a year, will only total 143 million viewing hours. So there's an obvious difference between the two. With dozens of major game titles released each year, most of which now include online play, there are easily billions of hours of playtime a year. Online games and virtual worlds have very similar statistics, especially considering that, according to the website GameStudies.org, the average person of 27.6 years plays approximately 22 hours a week, which is by far way too much. I don't know where they find the time. More interesting, though, are games such as Second Life and There, which, although not as popular as their action-based brethren, have a cyborgian effects on culture within and outside of itself. Second Life is the most interesting of the pure role-playing worlds at the moment, since not only can you create nearly anything you desire in the game, thanks to sophisticated graphics modeling and high-level programming languages, everything that you create, you literally and legally own, and can therefore trade and sell them for real-world money. Because of this concept, corporations have begun launching their own islands as mass marketing efforts. Wells Fargo, for example, recently created an area called Stagecoach Island containing many mini-games and activities such as skydiving, shopping, baking, whatever you wanted to do. This concept is a powerful one in that it creates a rift between the real world and the virtual world that no other online environment offers. Second Life's realistic world is interesting because it has allowed people with disabilities to play fully abled avatars capable of performing any activity they choose. A nonprofit organization called BrainTalk Communities creates online communities for patients suffering neurological disorders as well as their caregivers. BrainTalk Communities currently helps 200,000 people around the world with disorders ranging from Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, epilepsy, and so on. Most of the communities communicate online through simple bulletin boards or chat rooms, but two projects in particular, Project Brigadoon and Live to Give, have decided to create online communities of their own in Second Life. Second Life, which allows free access to an ever-expanding online world, is so open that the Brigadoon users, who all suffer from autism or Asperger's syndrome, have thus far created their own island, complete with a tavern called the Salty Dog, houses, a lighthouse, and so on. Live to Give, a sister project, consists of a group of 9 cerebral palsy patients who call themselves the Wilds, and play a single online character called Wild Cunningham, which you can see on the top right. Both, in the words of BrainTalk Community founder John Lester, who is the second to the right in the black, the point of the project is to give them a virtual world where they are free from the limitations of their physical world environment, to give them hope, and allow them to be productive members of a virtual space that they can call their own. Members of both projects mention how they not only allow their players to partake in an online environment that will, for example, give them an opportunity to virtually garden or build a boat, but they can also allow them to communicate with other subscribers who will not judge them on their physical appearance or mental disorders. A simple definition of identity is one where a person's identity is defined by her ideas about herself and the ideas that others have of her. How does this definition fit when we discuss a virtual world, especially one where a single person, such as Wild Cunningham, is controlled by multiple people? Where exactly does a person's identity come from? Manuel Castell suggests 3 distinct descriptions of identity: legitimizing, resistance, and project. Legitimizing identities are those that exist to support and rationalize our society's dominant institutions and social arrangements, such as national citizenship. Those who do not benefit from the existing system or are not yet part of it often feel excluded and start to form an identity in opposition to the legitimizing identity that Castell terms a resistance identity. These identities, such as women's rights movements, generally challenge the structure of our society to become less oppressive of the difference and more accommodating and more inclusive. Finally, project identities, as Castell puts it, arise when social actors, on the basis of whichever cultural materials are available to them, build a new identity that redefines their position in society, and by so doing, seek the transformation of the overall social structure. Global environmental and peace movements are good examples of this third type of identity. How do these 3 types fit with the Wild Cunningham and Project Brigadoon? Although on the surface, it may seem that these inhabitants of Second Life are resisting the dominant structures of our society, they are not trying to reform it or be a part of it in a classical sense. Perhaps a fourth category is in order, one where these identities are simply trying to be something they cannot be because of resistance against them beyond their control. As Darren Barney writes in The Network Society, our postmodern identity is constructed as a complex pastiche of relationships, choices, and acts enacted in a variety of parallel and overlapping contexts. Rather than being a fixed, natural, and unchanging condition corresponding to a stable situation and set of attributes, postmodern identity is artificial, fluid, contingent, multifaceted, and mutable. In other words, it's a lot like a network, which is why it's not very surprising that the rise of global networks, as Sherry Turkle in Life on the Screen writes, are not just changing our lives, but changing ourselves. Being online means inventing ourselves as we go along. You are who you pretend to be. Your identity on the computer is the sum of your distributed presence, an identity so fluid and so multiple it strains the limits of notion. There are 3 parts of the social construction of ourselves. First, networks are deterritorialized. In other words, they diminish geography as a factor in determining our identity. When we are online, it is more important where we can be contacted, where we can go, and what we can get, than where we are now and where we have come from. Second, network communication is incorporeal, removing the impact of the body, usually a fairly stable basis of identification as a marker of identity and social interaction. Finally, networks are opaque, which means that identification markers such as sex, age, skin color, and so forth must usually be volunteered, and even then cannot always be relied upon. Cameron Bailey, in an article entitled Virtual Skin, Articulating Race in Cyberspace, observes that it would seem clear that the safety of binary oppositions, self, other, black, white, male, female, straight, gay, writer, reader, would evaporate in the forcibly uncertain world of electronic discourse. A message comes and goes without a face. Communication takes place without bodies to ground it. In the online world, identity is often chosen, played with, subverted, or foregrounded as a construct. None of the usual landmarks can be trusted. Furthermore, a person can choose more than one identity, revising them as she sees fit. As with Cameron Bailey, many have argued for the emancipatory nature of global networks. Donna Haraway and Simian Cyborgs and Women, and Sadie Plant and Zeros and Ones, Digital Women in the New Technoculture, have both argued for the potential of the network environment for female emancipation, while Beth Kolko, among others, have argued the same for race. On the other hand, many have argued that the anonymity, disembodiment, and opacity of the networks avoid the real problem of discrimination and injustice that exists in the material offline world. Michelle Wilson, in an article titled Communication in the Abstract, writes that the dissolution of fragmentation of the subject and the instantaneous transient nature of all communication disconnect or abstract the individual from physical action and a sense of social and personal responsibility to others. As part of my thesis, I plan to investigate the impact these virtual worlds have on society and the individual using anthropological tools such as the pandemics, especially with Project Brigadoon in the wilds. Although these worlds are relatively new, their outstanding usage and growth and pervasiveness in our society demands that we pay close attention. In the future, there will only be more complex worlds such as Solipsis, Uru, Active Worlds, and Metaverse, all boundary-pushing projects modeled after the science fiction novel Snow Crash, where each individual person becomes a node connected to a network of networks that is modeled after a world and where their existence and identity is partially based on their physical connection to those networks. And on the screen, there's an example of the Metaverse, not in use at the moment, but the room itself would become a node in this network. And there would be different ways of connecting to the network, but this would be one in which, it's hard to explain really in like 2 minutes, but basically there's future worlds that are coming out that'll be very different than where we are right now. To close, I believe that it is important to ask, when we are online, are we ever in full control of our identity? That's it.
Thank you.